Okay, let's kick it off. Good morning, everybody. My name is Pat Ward. I'm the Administrative Law Judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as procedural hearing officer for this consolidated hearing. This is the hearing on the application of NSP for an ADP regarding termination of...
Good morning, everyone. My name is Pat Ward. I'm the Administrative Law Judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as procedural hearing officer for this consolidated hearing. This is a hearing on the application of NSP for an ADP regarding termination of biomass PPA with Benson Power and deferred accounting of costs regarding other PPAs at Pine Bend and Laurentian. This is North Dakota Public Service Commission consolidated cases number PU-17-270. 271 and 322. I understand from counsel that there is a settlement of these matters between NSP staff to be presented to the commissioners for consolidation for consideration today. The issues to be considered in these matters are: one, is NSP's proposal to terminate its biomass power purchase agreement with Benson Power LLC, acquire the Benson facility, and subsequently close the facility prudent? Number two, is NSP's proposal to terminate its power purchase agreement with Pine Bend Biomass Facility prudent? Three, is NSP's proposal to extend the terms of its Hennepin Energy Recovery Center power purchase agreement prudent? Four, should the commission grant deferred accounting treatments for the cost of the proposed Benson transactions? And five, should the commission grant deferred accounting treatments for the cost of terminating the Laurentian and Pine Bend power purchase agreements? The record will show that it is a little past 9 a.m., February 2nd, 2018. We're in the commission hearing room on the 12th floor of the state capitol, 600 East Boulevard Avenue in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the time, date, and place set by the notice of consolidating hearing. Mr. Simpson, please state your appearance for the record and appearance of any other counsel.
Zev Simpson, Briggs & Morgan, on behalf of applicant Northern States Power Company. With me is Lauren Pockle, also of Briggs & Morgan.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the advocacy staff. With me is Victor Shook, also part of advocacy staff.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, General Counsel for the Commission, and with me today is Jerry Lean on behalf of, advisory staff.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. My understanding is that you have some pre-marked exhibits, and I've been provided with a copy of an exhibit list. Is there a stipulation as to the admission of these exhibits?
Subject to no objections, the applicant and advocacy staff have agreed to stipulate those exhibits into the record.
Okay, and so...
Correct.
And so, from my understanding, from the exhibit list that was provided to me yesterday, we're talking about exhibits NSP 1 through 10 and PSC 1 through 5. Is that correct? Mr. Simpson?
That's correct.
Mr. Armstrong?
Yes.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any objection to any of these?
No, that's...
Okay, NSP exhibits 1 through 10 and PSC exhibits 1 through 5 will be received as stipulated.
Yeah.
And then I have to ask a question. I don't see anybody, but is there anyone present in the room other than witnesses for NSP or the commission that might testify today? Seeing none, nobody raising their hand or anything like that, I'm going to just skip over that part of my opening comments. And at this point, I'll ask for any opening remarks from the commissioners. Chairman Chrisman.
I do not have opening remarks other than to welcome everyone and look forward to getting all the information out of the settlement and asking a few questions as we go on the details of the case.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
I don't have opening comments either. Just here to listen to both sides on the settlement and hear what you've got to say about that, and just look forward to having an opportunity for questions then.
Commissioner Crosius.
I would echo the same thoughts. Welcome, everyone. Good morning. And anxious just to dig in and hear what everyone has to say.
Okay. Counsel, any opening remarks or comments, Mr. Simpson?
We'll reserve our comments for our first witness. I just have a few housekeeping items when may be appropriate, Your Honor.
Okay. You might bring those up now.
Sure. The NSP only plans to call our policy witness, but we have our other witnesses available should the commissioners have questions. And also our policy witness has an early flight to address some family commitments, and so we just want to be mindful of the time.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong?
No opening comments, just we also have Jim Heidel and Joel Jensen available by phone if the commission has questions for them as well. Victor Shook will be testifying in support of the settlement.
Okay, very good. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Nothing, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Simpson, go ahead and call your first witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Applicant calls Akash Chandra on another stand.
Chaturanda, I'm required by law to advise you of the law regarding perjury in the state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $10,000, or in some cases, both may be imposed. Having been advised of this penalty for perjury, I'll ask you to raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding? Thank you. Please take a seat. Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Chanarana. Can you state your name and title for the record, please?
There it is. My full name is Akash Himanshu Chandarana. My title is Regional Vice President, Rates and Regulatory Affairs.
And you are the same Akash Chandarana who submitted pre-filed direct and rebuttal testimony in this proceeding?
I am.
And I understand you have an opening statement, sir?
I do.
Please read it at your convenience.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for having me here today. It's nice to be here. I apologize for the fact that I have to have a little bit of a scheduling conflict, but I look forward to being back next week to talk to you guys about some other matters. My name is Akash Chandran. I am the Regional Vice President for Rates and Regulatory Affairs for Xcel Energy, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before the Commission today. The transactions under consideration today are part of Xcel Energy's continued interest in finding opportunities to decrease overall system costs and thus our customers' energy bills through the early termination of certain legacy generation obligations. While each of the transactions before the Commission is structured differently, they will have the ultimate effect of ending high-priced power purchase agreements and will result in cost savings to customers. The record reflects that advocacy staff agrees that these transactions will benefit our customers. In light of that agreement between the company and advocacy staff on the benefits of terminating the Benson, Pine Bend, and Laurentian PPAs, we were able to enter into a settlement agreement. The settlement agreement before you incorporates the benefits of these transactions by granting ADPs for them and provides for just and reasonable treatment of the termination costs. With respect to the HERC transaction, we continue to believe that the terms of the contract extension were prudent and consistent with the arm's length nature of our negotiations, the terms of the existing contract, and PURPA. However, we recognize that advocacy staff disagrees. Given this disagreement and that it is unlikely that the HERC transaction will clear other conditions precedent, the company agrees to withdraw its request for an ADP for that transaction as part of the overall settlement in these cases. The settlement agreement will therefore resolve this disagreement consistent with advocacy staff's recommendations. The settlement agreement also provides for the cost recovery of the Benson, Pine Bend, and Laurentian PPAs subject to refund. Specific to Laurentian and Pine Bend, it is agreed that these transactions meet the requirements for deferred accounting treatment. The company will recover the costs of these transactions through the fuel cost rider as they are incurred, consistent with the current treatment of the PPA costs. For Benson, deferred accounting also applies and a regulatory asset will be established, the recovery of which will be amortized equally over the 132 months following the closing of the transaction. The parties have agreed on a 5% rate of return on the purchased Benson assets, which reflects a compromise between the company's request for a full return and staff's no-return proposal. The cost of the Benson transaction will also be recovered through the fuel cost rider. The analyses performed by both the company and staff indicate that the settlement terms will result in customers paying less for their energy, even if the refund obligation is triggered. Because the terms of the settlement are in the public interest and will result in just and reasonable rates, I request respectfully that the Commission approve this agreement. I welcome any questions that will help aid in understanding the approval of the settlement agreement, and I thank you again.
Questions for Mr. Chandarana? Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I I just have one. You just mentioned that the HERC transaction may have some other hurdles that it wouldn't pass. And is that this Minnesota reconsideration that's in your, or are there other things too?
I think it primarily is a result of the order from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission denying approval of that transaction, and then the reconsideration as well, which I think the Minnesota Commission will take up shortly. But those are the primary hurdles.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Questions from the commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
I probably should have mentioned this in my opening, but just actually a few questions. Does this tie back to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act? Was that really the beginning of all of this in terms of when Yucca Mountain as a waste site wasn't moving forward? The Minnesota legislature, my understanding is, then created a mandate for biomass as an offset, or the use of biomass as an offset to be able to store nuclear waste on site. Is that generally speaking or not generally speaking?
Commissioner, that's it. I tried to lay out some of the history in my testimony, and generally speaking, the biomass requirements in the state of Minnesota were generally a trade to continue to store fuel on site, mm-hmm. and in a lot of ways to continue to run the nuclear plants. And so if you can't store the fuel on site, then you bump into a different issue, which is you can't actually consume the fuel because you have nowhere to put it. So that was a general agreement that was structured many years ago at the legislature, and then the biomass mandate has gone through numerous iterations over the years to try to refine it and work on it. But ultimately, that's the nature of the compromise, so to speak.
Okay. So if Yucca Mountain had been approved as a waste depository, this may not have even been put in place.
It's hard to say. I mean, and this just speculating at this point, but part of the trade too there is you had a point at which the operating license life, the NRC license period was going to expire. And so then again, we kind of sat down with everybody and revisited some statutory restrictions that would have allowed us to renew the license life and run the plants longer. So it's, there's a spent fuel component. There's also a NRC license, operating license life component to this as well. So it's hard to tell, but I do think that the original biomass compromise was structured around spent fuel.
Has the biomass production ever been advantageous to the customer base?
I think that, again, as I tried to articulate in my testimony, one of the benefits of, again, having different generation types is you've got a diverse portfolio base. And I think, like with everything, especially as you're embarking on trying out new technologies, is you get to experiment with them and you get to try to learn from them. And so I think that's where the benefits come from. I think one of the reasons why we felt really compelled in terms of pursuing the transactions that we did is recognition that in today's current market structures or current market pricing, these contracts are very expensive, and we had the opportunity to eliminate them and provide savings to our customers, and that's what we wanted to focus on.
Okay. Would it be fair to say that customers have been paying above market rate? And to me, it would strongly suggest and actually even indicate that customers have been paying more for this power than what could have otherwise been purchased on the open market.
These are really expensive contracts. Yeah. Right. I mean, I think we detailed them in terms of their prices, and they're significantly higher than current MISO market prices.
Yeah. And I think that's important to recognize that as a result of the mandate, the price of power has been more expensive, and that is not the fault of the company. You are required to meet those mandates. And I also realize that there is a trade-off in that nuclear-generated electricity is very attractive from a pricing standpoint. So do you balance the two? Do you bring them in together? And perhaps the net effect is still a positive. I haven't crunched those numbers. I have another question. On the application, it was indicated that North Dakota customers would realize 5.49% of the savings. That number doesn't seem consistent with a lot of the other numbers that I'm seeing in terms of North Dakota, the percent that is allocated to North Dakota for various things for the 94,000 customers that you serve in North Dakota. It seems to typically be a 6-point-something number. This is 5.49. Can you give me some background on that or explain that to me?
Sure. I mean, it's typically that, you know, the way that we do this is it's a jurisdictional cost allocation that we run based upon revenues that we're getting, and, you know, we just kind of, for lack of a better word, just kind of run a formula, and currently that allocator is telling us that North Dakota is about 5.5% of the system, and so it might be that we're seeing increased sales in some places or decreased sales in others, and that's what's causing the allocator to fluctuate. So it's not a static number. It's a fluid number that can change from time to time.
But present day 5.49 or 5.5, not to split hairs, but
yeah.
The app said 5.49. So
yep.
That is the current allocation.
That's
percentage.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. If I can't find the other question really quick, I may defer to the other commissioners while I search for it. Why don't we do that?
Commissioner Dorchak, want to go next, or Chrisman? Okay, Mr. Chrisman.
I want to just go back and make sure that through all the various filings, and then since you didn't go through all this testimony, just make sure I have some numbers right on these various projects. So Benson Power is about 55 megawatts. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Pine Bend is about 12.
That's correct.
Hennepin, although that's withdrawn, is about 34.
33.7. Yep.
And Laurentian is about 35. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And Pine Bend and Hennepin were PURPA projects. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And can you explain PURPA on our record?
I will do my best. PURPA is...
And as you explain it, then differentiate, because my next question is the Minnesota biomass mandate.
Sure. PURPA is a federal law that has been enacted in, I think, almost every state, if memory serves me. But I'm not going to go out on a limb on that one. And basically, the overall structure of it, or the overall requirement, is that certain generating facilities that meet the standards or meet the requirements set out in federal law, once met, have the right to basically sell their power to, in this case, Xcel Energy. And so if you're a qualifying facility, which is a term that's a term of art, and as designated as such, you can come to the company and basically say, I demand it, that you buy power from me. And the price at which that you buy power is typically the utility's avoided cost. And what that means is really then the art and the science of, or the art, I should say, of how to interpret that law. And is usually different and distinct as you go state by state. And so that is PURPA. In terms of the Minnesota biomass mandate, the state of Minnesota passed a law that articulated certain requirements that were imposed upon Xcel Energy as an operator of a nuclear facility in the state that required us to go buy power from certain facilities that met the characteristics set out in state law. And my recollection is the amount of megawatts that we had to purchase under that state law started at one point and then was amended to a different point and then was amended to a different point. And that is the difference between the two. One is really a creature of federal law. The other one is really a creature of state law. The biomass mandate is very specific to a certain type of characteristic, which is biomass-based fuels. PURPA is applicable to really a qualifying facility which can meet all sorts of different requirements, such as hydro, wind, solar, all sorts of things.
In both cases, green projects that they're promoting, correct?
I wouldn't call them necessarily green, but we're probably quibbling a bit. And part of that is because PURPA has a really broad, expansive umbrella, as is kind of the illustrated here. We've got some PURPA projects, which are technically biomass facilities, and some places view biomass as green because they generate renewable energy credits, and that is the case in the state of Minnesota. So if we're using green as tied to renewable energy credits, then yeah, then there's definitely a connection there.
And just for some context of the age of these, do I have it right about Benson Power around the 2000 time frame coming on?
That sounds about right. August 31st, 2000 is when we entered into the PPA there.
Okay, and I have Pine Bend, I'm thinking, in around 1994.
Let's see. And, yep, the PPA was entered into on September 20th, 1994.
Hennepin in 1990.
Contract began January of 1990.
And Laurentian 1998.
That sounds correct.
Okay. So, in that decade, was there a lens through which one would have looked at that time and at these contracts and said, as standalone contracts, that they were good for consumers, or were they contracts that were done to meet social engineering mandates?
Yeah, that's a really fair question. You're going to stretch me here because during that decade I was in high school and college, so I'll do my best here. I think that as I've looked back upon it, there's a couple of ways I would answer that. One is, PURPA has been around for quite a long time, and the policy basis around PURPA was really to open up the marketplace, so to speak, for small generators who were viewed to have a competitive disadvantage. And so the idea being you spur more competition, that should in some ways bring down prices. And so from that perspective, when you're looking at PURPA-specific contracts, I think there's a value proposition there too, which is, again, let's get more entrants into the market and see what happens. So I think from that perspective, there's something to be said. As I was talking to Commissioner Crosius as well, I do think that at some point you are trying to figure out whether or not some of these technologies can proliferate into something that's more sustainable is probably the best way to put it. So some of these contracts, for example, Benson has a 80-plus capacity factor, which is pretty decent. And so could that have materialized and proliferated into something that could have been bigger, provided a different resource that could have fit into our generation portfolio? Perhaps. The only way to find out is actually to try it. And so when we take ourselves back into the 90s, I think there's an element of, yes, a deal was struck at the legislature, which is we want you to try to experiment and use some different types of resources in exchange for continuing to store spent fuel on-site at the nuclear facilities. There's one element. I think you had a policy overlay at the federal level, which dates back to the 80s on PURPA, which is let's open up the market to new entrants. And then I think anytime you do have a mandate, you do end up in a situation where you've distorted the market to a certain extent. And so we have an obligation to buy, so we bought. And we tried on numerous occasions through competitive processes to bring in these types of contracts, and we were largely unsuccessful. And so I think you squish all that together and you've got the portfolio that you ended up with. And whether or not it's beneficial to customers today, I think what we're showing here is that it's more beneficial to customers to actually get out of these contracts than it is to stay with them.
To the extent these had to do with the nuclear storage licensing, did anything in these contracts make storage of that nuclear waste or operation of those nuclear plants any safer or more reliable or anything else beneficial?
No.
Or were these completely separate from that? Just
no, I mean, this is
an engineering mandate.
Yeah, this is what happens at the legislature. You make trades.
And the fact that you're here now wanting to be out of these contracts because they're high cost, was there something, I'm being careful not to accidentally say something that I've seen in the confidential files, but so is there something in these contracts that was open-ended and has escalated beyond expectations and caused them to now be high cost when they were signed, they looked like they would not be so high cost? Or were these just plain high cost contracts?
I mean, I think that anytime you get into a situation where we are under a requirement to buy, you have to look at what's the willingness of the counterparty to either sell their asset and more importantly, what's the motivation of the counterparty to terminate their arrangement with us. And so I think that that's a critical piece of this. And, so I kind of look at this as the right factors started to line up a few years ago. And the first domino to fall in that situation was the fact that Benson was in receivership, had new owners who were looking to get out. They did not want to run this plant. And the first party they called was us. And all of a sudden it got us thinking, well, if we could get this one, what else could we go get? And to start eliminating these out of our stack. And that's, to me, kind of, that was actually when all the pieces started to fit together for us. And I remember sitting in the meeting where we started talking about this and looking at this and going, we could really do a lot of good with this if we can get some motivation and get some movement around this and the motivation from the other sides to walk out of their contracts or leave their contracts. So I think that it's more complicated than just what's the price on the power purchase agreement. Where does it sit versus market? You have to have a willing counterparty. We had to really figure out how to make it work, and each transaction is a little different because of that. And ultimately, when PJ and his folks did some analysis and started to show us what the numbers started to look like, it was pretty big savings, which gave us a lot of motivation to go forward, really push hard for it.
But is there anything in these contracts that has significantly and unexpectedly escalated, or are these contracts what would have been expected to be at this point back when they were signed?
Yeah, there's nothing new. There's not like a lever in any of these contracts that said in 2019 they're going to balloon up in costs or something like that. It was, these contracts are largely, in terms of pricing terms, very similar to and by that I mean there are slight escalators in the pricing terms and they change each year, but these are largely the same contracts.
So when you described them earlier as high-cost contracts, they were high-cost contracts when they were entered into, and people knew when they entered into them that they would be high-cost contracts in 2018, right?
I don't know if folks understood if they were going to be high-cost contracts in 2018 because, again, the MISO market is, you know, something that came along more recently than when we signed these contracts. And when I use the term high cost, I'm using that in reference to looking at the power purchase price tag and comparing it to a market value.
Is there somewhere in here where these are described as a pretty small part of NSP's overall generation mix?
Yeah, I believe that.
So are they high cost and compared to most of your other generation?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
When we're doing rate making and regulating, should we be striving to see that costs are paid by the consumers that actually benefit from them? Is that kind of the part of the goal of regulatory world?
Yeah, in my opinion, the goal of regulation is to match costs and benefits.
And in this case, will we be able to look back in hindsight and over the next 11 years say that the new consumers who have come on the market, say after 2020, mm-hmm. and under this settlement, still paying this rider, are getting any benefit out of these contracts?
I think I understand the question. I mean, I think one of the ways that the settlement is structured is intended to avoid situations of intergenerational inequities. And part of that is by structuring it as an immediate flow through or trying to match up the costs that are being paid for the termination similar to how the PPAs are being paid for. And so, you know, you could structure this in different ways, but the way in which the settlement is structured is intended to help so that your customer today is getting the benefit and paying the costs associated with the termination.
Is this a fair assessment? If we approve this, for these coming 11 years, the consumers that are paying it will kind of be benefiting from it. At least they didn't have to pay what would have been paid had we not done this and they had to continue paying these contract costs. But they really never did benefit from the facilities that are being paid for with this ride.
Yeah, I think the benefit here is that the customers are now getting the benefit of a lowered cost in comparison to the alternative, which is that the facility would continue to run. And so I think that's the way I think of the benefit in my mind.
And one of these goes out over 11 years, but do you have a time frame for, are they all for the 11 years?
No.
Is it spread out for that, or can you go through the time frame of
that? Yeah, I'll do my best. Yep, Benson is, so the way that Benson transaction works is we will create a regulatory asset for essentially the costs associated with consummating the transaction plus winding down the facility, and that will amortize that regulatory asset over 11 years, which is essentially the remaining term of what would have been the power purchase agreement. Pine Bend works a little differently. Pine Bend, the best way to think of it is that there is a ceiling of payments that we will make to get out of the power purchase agreement, which equals about a little over $1 million. I think the exact number is $1,050,000 or something to that extent. And so that will be essentially worked out each year. We think for a period of 2 years, we will flow through on an annual basis into the fuel clause a value stream until we hit that cap. So no more than 3 years, we think it'll be two. So much shorter period of time. Laurentian is, again, a little bit different than that. I'm just going to turn to the Laurentian application so I get it right. of pieces.
May I point you to page 7, bottom paragraph, and page that continues on to page 8 of the application?
You're referring to NSP 8, right?
Yes. Yes.
In terms of Laurentian, Commissioner Christman, the termination payment is going to be divided into equal payments that will be paid over a six-year period. So that one's over a six-year period of time. And I think that... Kirk is withdrawn, and so that should be everybody. So you have a period of 2 to 3 years for Pine Bend, a period of 11 years for Benson, and 6 years for Laurentian.
Thank you for clarifying that. And then earlier when I asked about PURPA and the Minnesota mandate being for green power, and you clarified, is it fair to say that it's for that? Both are for to encourage renewable power as opposed to green.
I think that what I keep going back to is if it generates a renewable energy credit, I think that that's the way I think of it. And the reason why is, and I'll just give this example, under PURPA, hydro facilities can be deemed a qualifying facility. Under Minnesota law, one example, depending upon the size of a hydro facility, it may or may not qualify as a renewable energy facility. It may not generate a renewable energy credit. And that's where I get – that's where it's kind of hard to, you know, line up these two different laws because they don't line up. And so that's why I'm just struggling with, you know, just saying yes, even though in principle I generally understand and agree with what you're trying to get at, which is – there's a type of basket of resources that are, air quote, renewable, that kind of fit into both of these.
And these three all qualify for the renewable energy credits.
Yeah, my recollection is, yeah. Yep.
And especially under PURPA, does just the fact that this is a voluntary agreement between these producers and the company... is that what kind of would get you off the hook from your description of PURPA? Was it that the company has to buy their power at your avoided cost? And so if we do this, what prevents them from just saying, well, federal laws, you have to keep buying it?
Well, with PURPA, it's a must take, but, you know, take Pine Bend, for example, which is a PURPA contract. You know, part of this is that they can't come back to us, you know. So, and one of the challenges with HERC is it's a PURPA facility. And so, you know, I mean, ideally you try to figure out a relationship or a structure where you could work it out with them. But, yeah, they continue to have, under their existing power purchase agreement, a 7-year window. But they are a QF, and unless you can get them to say, I'm going to waive that must take right, you kind of sit in that circle.
So Pine Bend is permanently waiving that?
Pine Bend is, yes. They are, we will not see them again.
Benson Power, you're actually acquiring the facility and eliminating it, so that one can't come back.
Correct.
To bite us. And Laurentian, what's this? Refresh me on the status of that.
Sure.
After
If it's approved. Laurentian is, we are terminating their contract. They will not come back to us with a new power purchase agreement. And my understanding is that they intend on selling the power to market or using it for purposes associated with their local utility, their municipal utility.
Okay. And then lastly, is it all three of these would be covered in the fuel clause rider?
That's correct.
Under the settlement? So if, as a consumer, I would read the... I would assume that the fuel clause rider is covering the cost of the fuel that I'm using.
Correct.
And we're not going to be getting fuel for this. So I find that not intentionally necessarily, but I find that misleading to the consumers to pay for this cost in the fuel cost rider. And so I'm wondering, why isn't it in the renewable rider in that we're paying the cost of these mandates that were done to promote renewable energy? And so why not the renewable rider instead of the fuel clause rider?
Yeah, I think, Commissioner, this is the settlement that we structured. I think, again, some of this follows a very similar approach that we took in Minnesota, which is to flow through the cost through the fuel clause rider. Again, as power purchase agreements, most of these costs flow through the fuel cost rider. And so, again, this is where the PPAs would flow through anyway. Why not keep the cost there? Because in a lot of ways, you can flip this around and say, this is no different than this is similar to another of a transaction cost that you could create the analogy to as just a power purchase agreement. Your point's well taken. It's not quote-unquote fuel. But at the same time, this is also where these costs have resided for many years.
They have, but you're not required to do things the same in both states, are you?
No, and my point is not that because we're doing it that way in Minnesota, we do it here in North Dakota. It's simply that as power purchase agreements, they have flowed through the fuel clause rider here for many years. And really, when you look at what we're doing here, it's a cost of a transaction that we're keeping in the fuel cost rider. And so I think that you can continue to allow it to happen too if you'd like to.
But if we chose not to, would it make a financial difference to the company which rider it was collected on if everything else were approved?
I don't think so. No. So I think that, you know, our original proposal was, you know, deferred accounting. I think we've talked extensively with staff to figure out what made the most sense. I mean, I'd have to talk to my folks back at the shop to make sure, but for us, it's the fact that we're getting more real-time recovery is a very critical piece of this. That's what's helpful.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning, Akash.
Good morning.
Thanks for your testimony so far. I just have a couple additional questions.
Okay.
First of all, what's happening with HERC? Like, where does that go now?
You know, the HERC they themselves petitioned for reconsideration at the Minnesota Commission. We'll see how that plays out. And we've started the process of talking to them about what can we accomplish with their contract.
How long is the contract with them?
The contract technically has expired. It did at the end of last year, but they are in they have a 7-year extension period under that existing contract. And so technically I would say they still have 7 more years left.
And you have to, if they want to extend it, you have to?
Well, that's the terms of the existing contract is okay. A 7-year period of time under which we're still operating. It kind of goes to what I was talking to Commissioner Christman about, which is, you know, say we just rode that 7-year period out and we're unsuccessful in arbitration. And there's a provision in there, too, that requires us to go through binding arbitration. And let's just say we were unable to successfully go through arbitration, which I'm not entirely sure what that looks like. But we were unable to do that. Then at the end of that 7-year period, they could just come back to us and say, I'm a QF, I want you to take... And then we'd enter into a new set of negotiations. So, but as it sits right now, 7 more years.
And the cost that you have to pay under that is the original? It's not negotiated down?
Yeah, I think I think right now we're, I memory serves me, that we're in some form of like an avoided cost structure for the time being as we go through renegotiations and potentially binding arbitration.
Okay. So how do you anticipate that coming forward here again?
You know, I really don't know. I'm just being really honest about it, because I feel like there's a lot of different layers to this particular transaction. And some of that is some shifting sands around, like, what is market value, mm-hmm. and how that's being interpreted and being defined, and what really is avoided cost and what the definition of that is. And I think really we need to get some clarity around what those two phrases mean before I have a really good sense of how that transaction is going to continue to move forward.
And remind me again, I know you told Randy, but how many megawatts is HERC?
I think HERC is in the 30 megawatt range.
All right.
It's 33.7.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What changed in Minnesota in the last legislative session that triggered their further refining of the requirements of the mandate? I'm reading on page 11 of your testimony,
sure.
that in the most recent session it was amended and gave you more flexibility to take action in the best interest
okay.
of customers and blah, blah, blah. So did the company go to the legislature and say, listen, we want to change this? How did this happen?
Yeah. So the short, long version of it is that as we were negotiating with Benson and we were having discussions with them, we could see that the transaction was going to come together. And at the same time, we were starting to pick up the phone and talk to other sellers that had biomass facilities and other, you know, PURPA sellers, and just a lot of other folks to see what we could do with the stack. And I was asked, you know, do you think that we can get this through the regulatory process as the biomass statute was written? And my opinion was, yes, we can. That being said, you know, I think anytime you're measuring commercial risk, you do evaluate what does that risk look like. And the decision was, you know, as a group was made that if we can go get some clarity to the biomass statute, that we should try to do that to help facilitate the transactions moving through the regulatory process in a more seamless way. And a lot of that comes back to the fact that, you know, these are facilities that are in communities, and they have impacts. You know, they will have an impact on those communities, and they have impacts on vendors and so forth. And so we decided to bring forward, we brought forward legislation to clarify the biomass mandate to allow us to terminate these contracts. And I continue to believe that we didn't need the legislation, but it was nice to have it so that it made it clearer for our commission in Minnesota to be able to evaluate the law and say, okay, I can see where we can go with this.
And how, describe that. I'm trying to get a feel for the landscape in Minnesota on these kind of policies right now. So the most recent session, this was adopted, signed by the governor.
Yep.
Describe how it was received. Was it a big fight? Was there widespread agreement that it was time to, that this was fair? Tell me about that.
Sure. You know, one big change that occurred in the legislature is that we now have a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and so the driving force around this, which is to get customer bills down, really resonated with Republican lawmakers. They like that, and so there was definite support on that principle. And that being said, it wasn't that we showed up and said, hey, we have a way to lower bills. Here's what it looks like. And everybody said, yay. It was, there was definitely concern, and the concern came from vendors such as, you know, folks that depend upon and have depended upon these facilities for, you know, burning fuel, be it turkey litter, be it wood product. Definitely concern from the communities themselves where there's jobs located and what are going to happen to those jobs. And so, you know, I would say that what started off as, you know, a relatively straightforward piece of legislation, then as you can see from, you know, the attachment to my, I think the application, became very all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. You know, it turned into a lot of pieces, not only to make it clear that we could terminate them, but then also what to do with certain funds to help ameliorate some of the issues in the community.
And where did the anti-nuclear people have any concerns over changing this? Was that part of the discussion or not really?
No, I don't think so. You know, I participated somewhat in the legislative process. That does not stick with me as something that really, you know, jumps out to the forefront of my mind.
Or the folks who are proponents of sort of Minnesota being on the cutting edge of experimenting with new renewables and trying to be a leader in that. Were they opposed to this?
There's definitely some, again, and this is part of the shift in landscape where you've got a Republican House controlled, Republican Senate and House, is that there was definitely some clamoring around the edges of maybe we should, you know, look at some other types of technologies and you know, maybe re-divert some resources in that front, but not really gaining enough momentum that that became important or critical to the negotiations.
Okay. And then one more question kind of along that same nature. Is there any sense looking back on this that like this is a lesson learned, let's not do this again type of thing, or not?
It's so hard to tell, and that's just me being very transparent. I mean, you could have another election come through, and you're going to see, you know, you could see like a shift again in the House and Senate, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got enough momentum going that all of a sudden there's a new mandate that's out there. So I think that the base of lawmakers that got behind this, that understand how important it is to keep bills flat, to drive bills down, and that that's beneficial for economic development, that's beneficial for the economy as a whole, get it. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen in subsequent elections, and I don't know.
And then did the company, as part of your effort to bring forward that legislation and make your case, did you quantify the cost of these projects and how much customers paid?
We did.
Okay.
We did.
So that must have been pretty compelling.
It was very compelling.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's it, Akash. Thank you.
Yep.
Oh, one more question, sure. Actually. This is unrelated, but you mentioned the allocator fluctuates, the allocation factor.
Yeah.
I guess that's – I didn't realize that. When,
I'm probably,
when is that done?
I saw a lot of scribbling over there, and he's. I know he's going to come back.
We can help you out.
Okay.
So
we'll all learn that.
My spidey senses went up that my lawyer was unhappy with my answer, which is probably a good indication for me to stop talking. So.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Redirect, Mr. Sensor?
Just a few short ones, Mr. Chandarana.
Great.
Based on your –
what they're about.
No. Based on your recollection, is it now that you've had some time to think about the issue, would it be fair to say that the North Dakota operations are about 6.2% of the Minnesota company, but really about 5.4% of the total NSP system?
That's correct.
And with respect to the fuel cost rider, how it fluctuates, you know, if you think back about when we were flipping through the tariff pages, it's based on percentage of sales of the total system, and those sales do fluctuate, don't they?
That's correct. Thank you for clarifying.
No problem. And then one more clarification question. Back when we used to work together, do you recall that PURPA also allows for thermal generation up to 80 megawatts to qualify as a qualifying facility?
Sadly, I do, because I worked on this way too much. Yeah.
Right. No, nothing further.
Mr. Armstrong.
Nothing.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
I have a couple. And actually, it's for both parties. I'd just like today or in a late-filed response, both parties to identify if the current language of the fuel adjustment rules would permit recovery of the costs or if a deviation would be necessary. There is a provision for deviation in order to recover the transaction costs through the fuel adjustment. And I kind of have the same question about the renewable tariff. If the current language could accommodate recovering those costs through that tariff rider, or if that would have to be, if changes would have to be proposed, and then what would they be? So I don't care if I get one response or two. I'd like to know if the parties agree and get a response to those.
We can certainly prepare one for you.
So it wasn't a question for you, but it's a request. Unless you know the answer right now.
I think Zev will throw something at me if I wade in and try to offer an answer.
I think that's right.
Okay, commissioners, Commissioner Crocious.
Well, the good news is I found the question that I was looking for. The bad news, I have four more beyond that. So,
okay.
Was Xcel aggressively looking at biomass prior to the Minnesota mandate being put in place? And I know that would be before your time when you were in elementary school or however you phrased it.
I don't know the answer to that. I couldn't even wade into that one.
Okay. Could these any of these facilities, Pine Bend, Benson, or Laurentian, have been retired earlier? Or do you think from a practical standpoint or a contractual standpoint this is as quickly as this could have happened?
My personal opinion is this is as quickly as it could have happened. If you're a counterparty and you've got a power purchase agreement that's still got 11 more years on it or 10 more or whatever, your motivation to sell and get out of that contract is not necessarily very high. You've got a set revenue stream that's coming in, and I think that the right opportunity emerged and we were able to capitalize on it.
Yeah, the reason I ask, going back to some of the earlier comments I made, while I can certainly be pleased that there will be savings for North Dakota consumers, it also indicates that they've been paying more than they should have for that percentage of electricity power that they've been utilizing. And just to dovetail on some earlier comments, and this is more of just a statement, it does become frustrating that customers are incurring a higher rate for a project or a mandate that was really a reaction to the nuclear waste issue. And while renewable, in some instances, CO2 emissions actually from burning wood can be 2, 3, up to 5 times greater than coal, for example, at least from the limited amount of reading I've been. But I think the lesson here is that sometimes, in this case, the Minnesota legislative body thought it was advantageous for customers from either a perception standpoint to say, well, this is the offset. We'll do something good over here because we're storing nuclear waste on site. But the net effect was actually not good for customers. But with that said, not to assume, but I would have to believe that full recovery for these facilities, in fact, I think I do know the answer. That has been granted by the North Dakota Public Service Commission or prior commissions dating way back to the inception of these facilities, correct?
That's correct. And, you know, one thing that I'll point out about the settlement agreement is, and I don't want to dive too far into this, but just, you know, a few rate case ago, we worked out a, for lack of a better word, a penalty provision, so to speak, that we could continue to recover the costs of the biomass facilities subject to us being able to get a simple cycle or a gas facility, a thermal facility built in eastern part of the state. And the settlement agreement captures, you know, brings that forward or retains that. And so to the extent that North Dakota customers are paying for the transaction costs, that's going to continue to be calculated as part of the refund obligation should we fail to honor our commitment there. So I'm just pointing that out in the sense that, yes, these costs have been approved by a prior commission. There has been a settlement that has talked about the ongoing recovery of that, and the existing settlement or the new settlement further considers the payments to get out of these contracts as part of that as well.
If you had the choice, there weren't any remaining mandates in place, would you continue to utilize biomass?
No. No.
Okay. No further questions for me.
Mr. Chrisman.
I'm glad you got into that as far as that gas plant, because it is important, I think, that we discuss it here for people who might be monitoring this and don't necessarily have all the other information. Does this, if that plant is not built, the penalties involved, does this lower the amount than what would have been if this settlement is not reached?
Yes. I mean, it does lower the amount of the penalty in the sense that if we keep the biomass contracts in place on a nominal basis and a net present value basis, nominal, let's just use nominal, the refund would be higher. That being said, the settlement agreement takes the transaction costs and incorporates that into the calculus for the refund so that the value of the refund is still very significant.
But slightly less.
It's slightly less. I mean, in my opinion, the better thing is that we get rid of these contracts and get those off of the books. And I think the settlement strikes the right balance in the sense that it still, you know, it doesn't render the refund obligation, it doesn't take the teeth out of it.
And I don't know if this is a question for you or someone else, but if this settlement is approved and whatever the time frame is that these facilities are completely offline, and in the case of Benson, it's cleaned up and gone, is there any reason to maintain the trade secret protection for the amount of what these contracts were, or can that information be made public then?
It's probably a better question for the lawyers, quite frankly. I mean, I think some point down the road, I would imagine we would not have as much concern over it. But these are things that are also sensitive to the developers and the sellers as well. And so, you know, take Laurentian, for example. Laurentian's not going away. They themselves are going to maintain their facility. They're just using it for their own purposes. For them, the information that's in this filing regarding their facility is probably going to matter to them for as long as they run that facility.
No other questions. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Fedorchak.
I don't have any other questions.
Okay. I think that's it for Mr. Chandrana.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong, anything further for him before he...
Oh, nothing for him, no.
For the airport? Mr. Jeffcoat Sackle.
Nothing, thanks.
Okay, you're free to go. Mr. Simpson, where do we go next?
We rest.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong.
Call Victor Shook.
Okay, before we do that, let's take about a 10-minute break. We'll come back at 10:15.
Thank you. No, but we the FCR rules. Well, there is a place in there for a deviation, but I thought you guys would film that.
My assumption would be
we'll get back
approval
on
of the approval of the settlement.
Yeah, since it was noticed, so we need to do a notice of opportunity.
That's fine. The RER.
No, but I was hoping, yes.
They're pretty consistent.
The RER.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see any problems. Right. Yeah. Oh, it's well, there's latent play that I
okay, back on the record, it's about 10:20. Mr. Shook, you're in the witness stand. You know the drill, so I ask you to raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding.
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Can you just state your name and position, please?
Victor Shook. I'm a public utility analyst for the North Dakota Public Service Commission.
And you've been appointed to advocacy staff in this case?
Yes, I have.
And you've submitted pre-filed testimony, is that correct?
Yes.
And that is marked as Exhibit PSC-5?
Correct.
And do you affirm that testimony here today?
Yes, I do.
That's all the questions I have for the witness.
Okay. Mr. Simpson, any questions?
No questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions.
Okay. We'll go to the commissioners. Commissioner Crocius. Questions for Victor.
Victor, do you agree with the, well, obviously you do, but the allocation methodology?
Yes. I think what makes that difference between, you know, the 6.6 roughly percent and the 5.49, for the 5.49, you're adding on NSP Wisconsin, so it kind of changes that allocation. You know, when we look at system resources, it's NSP Minnesota versus energy. It's the entire NSP system.
Okay. I don't have any other questions.
Mr. Chrisman, we got to test him a little.
Okay. I had asked Akash some of these, and I'm wanting to know your opinion, too. Do you see anything in these contracts that would have changed significantly and unexpectedly that caused them to now seem like high-cost contracts that are not good for the consumers, but years ago would have looked like they weren't high cost and not good for consumers?
I don't see anything in them that would have drastically changed in all of a sudden kind of a manner. This is, you know, roughly what the initial intent was of the contracts to be, you know, somewhere around this price point.
No cost plus provisions or anything like that in there that have suddenly elevated beyond expectations?
No.
Okay. And in our kind of rate-making goal of having consumers pay for the costs that are associated with delivering services to them instead of shifting it to other consumers or other generations, in hindsight, is this working right? Are the consumers in 2023 going to be getting a benefit from these contracts?
For the current termination of the PPAs, I think they will be getting a benefit in that if this were not to happen, closing out of these PPAs with the various different methods that we're laying out in the settlement agreement, they would otherwise be continuing to pay at the contractual rates still laid out in there. So their benefit is they don't have to pay that higher rate. They are paying for replacement energy cost, which we believe to be less, far less than what the contractual amounts are, even when considering paying these termination costs. So, and that's also kind of why we were proposing to or agreeing to pass these through the fuel clause rider. That's where these PPA costs would otherwise have shown up. So those same customers at the same amounts that they would have paid were the PPAs to stay in place, will pay for the contractual closing costs.
So is it accurate to say that those consumers years out will benefit from getting out of the contracts, but they will not be beneficiaries from the fact that we ever got into them?
Correct.
Okay. And then regarding the fuel clause rider, you work with this stuff regularly. Do you think most people, most consumers, when they look at their bill, think that their fuel clause rider is for acquisition of fuel or acquisition of resources to avoid fuel costs?
No, they most likely do not.
I think I asked that.
Do you think
that they think that the fuel clause rider is for the purchase of fuel or the avoidance of fuel costs?
Fuel cost, yeah. not the avoidance of.
And do you consider these contracts to have been entered into for the purposes of promoting renewable energy?
At the time they were entered into in the 90s and early 2000s, I would assume so. I don't know specifically, you know, why the company made those decisions, but it falls in line with what we've heard from Akash as far as, you know, what was happening in the Minnesota legislature at the time.
So wouldn't it also be fair then to think that the consumers would have a more accurate understanding of what they're paying for these next 11 years if this were in the renewable rider?
It would be another alternative, and it could make more sense to consumers. My concern with doing that, having not looked at all of the how those splits work out in that rider versus the fuel clause rider, you may be having different percentages going to different classes.
But if you haven't looked at that, then you're not sure of that?
I'm not certain of that. It may be exactly the same, but that would be my concern, is that the same customers who otherwise would have paid these contract costs if the PPAs were to continue should be paying these termination costs.
And since we're not sure of that, we're also not sure which way would be the more correct allocation either.
How?
If there is a difference in how much different customer classes pay between the renewable rider or the fuel clause rider, since we don't, not even sure if there's a difference, we're not sure which one would be the more precise allocation either, or the more correct allocation.
In my opinion, this one, the fuel clause rider, would be the more correct one to match, you know, who's getting the benefit of these contract terminations versus who would have ultimately paid these, the higher costs. I think the fuel clause rider would be best. The split between the classes issue would come out in, you know, renewable riders are not just energy trackers, where this is, in theory, an energy tracker, you know, be it through fuel or purchase power. And conversely, the renewable rider could have some small capacity or purchase of renewable energy cost in it as well. And that's why that split could work out different. I'm just not familiar with what NSP's language says.
We'll have to dig into that a little more then.
Certainly.
I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Morning, Vic.
Morning.
So following along, Commissioner Christman, the current PPAs that the company has for wind projects, do those go through the fuel cost rider or the renewable rider?
I believe it's going to be a mixture. I don't know every wind project that the company has and where it's located off the top of my head. I would assume, like the other utilities we have in the state, it is kind of a mixed bag, where some of them could be through fuel clause rider. Like fuel clause riders work really well for purchase power agreements.
What's the point of the renewable riders? And I thought we created the renewable rider to track for customers the expense of renewable PPAs. So I guess that's curious to me that they might be in the fuel cost rider.
They could be. So the renewable rider can be used for PPAs for wind projects, or they could be used for owned wind projects as well.
Okay.
So
I see.
You would have
Not just PPAs.
Right.
Got it. Okay. I don't have a huge feeling either way on where which rider goes through. So
sure.
If Commissioner Crispin wants to see it in a different one, I'm open to that. Can you tell me a little bit from your perspective what's going on with that Hennepin County one? What do you expect to see? Where do you expect to see that, and how's that going to really carry itself out?
I would hope that this causes the county to renegotiate a little firmer stance on a lower rate for that contract. I think it would be hard for them to get out of it entirely due to the contract language. Not terribly fond of the contract language, but it was something that existed before any of us were here. But I would hope they negotiate a much better, more favorable rate. Mm-hmm.
And so they did negotiate a more favorable rate than what they currently have.
I'm trying
to
recall.
What was in here was certainly not worse than what they currently have. So I'm curious from an advocacy standpoint how you guys decided to draw the line and say even a little bit better does not warrant, we want a lot better.
Well, little bit better in that case is still extremely expensive. So,
but less than what customers are currently paying.
Right.
Was it a further longer commitment of time that they were proposing?
No.
I guess
no.
To me, I'd rather see it go down some than none at all. And then unless the reduction in cost, whatever it was, however small it was, also came with a longer commitment of time under the whatever their negotiated contract was.
No, I don't believe it was a longer period of time. It was the pricing was just not favorable. Relative to market pricing, it was extremely expensive.
But it
and
was
when comparing it
less
to
than what we're going to be paying the way it is.
Paying for that.
The contract as it exists that we're still obligated to now, even though, right, we're still going to be paying that.
We're still paying it, but I think from what I've understood, it's at the avoided cost rate between January 1, when the contract ended, and whenever this is settled, it's at the avoided contract avoided cost rate, which
see.
Is a kind of a disputed amount. But
so, and until they negotiate a new rate, that's what it stays at.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
And in theory, the new contract rate, whatever they would come to, could have a provision that, well, we're going to agree to this amount for that interim time period when we didn't have the contract in place. So that would be another point we would be.
I forgot that piece, that it was at the avoided cost today, not the previous contract rate, which was not a favorable term. Okay, that's it for me. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Armstrong.
Nothing further.
Mr. Simpson.
Just a couple of quick questions, Mr. Shook. I know we've looked at it in the past, but is it your recollection that NSP's renewable energy rider is limited to just company-owned capital projects located in North Dakota?
Yes.
And I know we've talked about it in the past, but is it your recollection also that all of NSP's power purchase agreements are recovered through the fuel cost rider here in North Dakota?
Yes.
Okay. Nothing further.
Okay, I think that's helpful. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Yes, thanks. I have nothing further.
Okay, commissioners, one more time around. Mr. Crocius?
Nothing further.
Mr. Crispin?
Nothing further.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Nothing for me.
Okay, Victor, I think you can step down. Mr. Armstrong?
We rest.
Okay, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, anything else?
No, thank you.
Okay, so.
Your Honor, I believe we have an obligation to make a late filed exhibit filing per Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco's request. Given the that conditions precedent are still pending for these transactions. We'd like to do that as quickly as possible. Subject to Mr. Armstrong telling me I'm crazy, we'd like to file something by the end of next week.
That's right.
Okay, and what are we going to call this late-filed exhibit?
We're going to call it a rider analysis.
Okay. Okay, anything further for the good of the order? Any closing remarks, counsel? Mr. Simpson?
No, Your Honor, except for thank you for giving us the opportunity to present what we think is a settlement that is very much in the public interest and helps the company lower costs for customers.
Okay, Mr. Armstrong.
No closing comments other than obviously we entered into a settlement agreement that we think is fair and reasonable and just request that it be granted. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
We have nothing except a small request for a proposed order.
Date time? You mean a date and time for that? Can we do that at the end of next week as well?
Sure thing.
Okay. We'll say the end of next week. I'll figure out the date. I think it's February 9th. So we can do it by February 9th, a week from today?
You got it.
Okay. That sounds great. Commissioners, closing comments? Commissioner Crocius?
Oh, thank you, everyone. Thank you to our staff, Mitch, as well, for the work that you have done on this. Thank you to the company. But just as I was going through this, continues to, I don't know if I want to call it a lesson learned but when I think of, again, and I mentioned this earlier, the reaction that the Minnesota legislature had when you go back in time related to the nuclear waste issue, and that the biomass was put in place for whatever reason. I can only speculate that it was a make good, an offset for being able to store waste on site, which it was, nuclear waste on site, but they turned out to be incredibly inefficient sources of generating power, and it is good to keep that in mind as we look for toward the future. And the rearview mirror, as they say, is quite small. The windshield is quite large, and you learn, though, as you move forward. So I think this is certainly advantageous, obviously, since it will be a positive for the North Dakota consumers. You know, I'm concerned with the fact that they've been paying higher than market rate for this particular type of power for a considerable period of time. And again, not the fault of the company. You have to comply to mandates as they are issued. So, again, just thank you for the hard work everyone put in on this. Appreciate it.
Chairman Christman.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I had a number of things that I clarified, details that I wanted to make sure I was accurate on, since we did this abbreviated oral testimony instead of going through this whole stack of fresh information. And so I'm going to assume that the lawyers are going to wave their hands if I'm wrong on these two. I just have them written down the whole time and forgot to ever clarify. But I believe that these three projects amount to $519 million in savings over the 11 years, and that is about $28.5 million for the North Dakota customers' share. Hopefully that's at least close. And so the point that I want to make off of that is this. I hope that there are lessons learned in this, that when deals are entered into and priority isn't given to whether projects are needed or not, or whether they are the lowest cost or at least somewhere near the lowest cost options, that's how you get into situations where you buy your way out of contracts at hundreds of millions of dollars of costs to people who had nothing to do with making the decision on the social engineering that got you into the contracts. And so I hope we're learning a lesson at least from this.
Commissioner Fedorchak, before I just, we don't have a sworn witness, but I saw some heads nodding affirmatively to the numbers that you were putting out there. So
they're in the ballpark.
Yeah, we had, both sides had different testimony on the numbers. The 28.5 was the number that the PSC or our witnesses came up with. So they're in the ballpark.
Commissioner Fedorchak, final words.
Great. Well, thank you for the interesting hearing this morning. I had done just a little napkin math and come up with about $25 million in savings, so I guess that's about the ballpark that we're all talking about for North Dakota customers, which is substantial. And so I echo some of the thoughts of my colleagues that this is kind of a case that illustrates, again, the differences between North Dakota and Minnesota's approach. Minnesota likes being on the cutting edge. They like experimenting. It appears to me that they want to do this, and I suspect that while we see it as a lesson learned that we wouldn't repeat this, I think that I suspect there's many in Minnesota who are very comfortable with being on the cutting edge of development of new energy resources and fully recognize that there's a cost to that and that that's what they want to do. So I don't believe that there will be lessons learned. I think that we'll continue to have this conflict and we'll have to mitigate that as best possible for our consumers and customers, continually working forward, trying to find a path that works for North Dakota, for the company, and in addressing your mixed directives. So this one is a good one, though. I think it's great that we can exit out of these contracts and save customers money and that we can all agree that that's a good approach. So to that end, I really applaud you all who worked on the settlement agreement and look forward to making it, you know, final as soon as possible.
And I want to thank everyone for an excellent job today, an expeditious hearing, very informative. Wish you a good weekend. Enjoy the Super Bowl. And I'll close the hearing on cases number PU-17-270, 271, and 322, subject to the filing of late-filed exhibits. And again, February 9th is the date for the filing of exhibits and for the proposed order. That's it. We're off the record.
Thank you.